This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you program your alarm clock and your calendar and your phone to have that very special ringtone. You program your budget, shopping lists, menus, workout, and special playlists for every mood. And aren't you just the picture of organization and independence and freedom? Look at how digital gadgets have set you free, Ms. Modern, Mr. Modern. But sadly, while you've been amusing yourself in your little digital sandbox, the machines have been making their own bigger sandbox, growing their own intelligence, writing their own programs, doing their own coding, independent of you, independent of humans. Who and what has been set free here?
If you control the code, you control the world.
When security advisor Mark Goodman said this in a 2012 TED Talk, it was probably already true that intelligent machines controlled their own worlds. Now they're on to ours. Jason Tanz is the editor-at-large for Wired and wrote the June cover story, The End of Code and Future of AI. Joshua Cooper Ramo authored the book, The Seventh Sense. He says the era of networks has already magnified the power of autonomous computers in ways that have massive, unforeseen consequences. Welcome to the real world, Neo. And there's no map. Let's have a lively romp through these ideas with Jason Tanz and Joshua Cooper Ramos. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, hello. Thanks for having me.
So we got two really big ideas here. One is autonomous machines that learn but don't necessarily need human coders to define what it is they do. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, more or less. The idea for this story came about from a conversation I was having with Andy Rubin, who was one of the founders of Android, a big AI geek. He's been working on AI for most of his career.
Artificial intelligence.
Yes, that's right. And he was saying that while he's very excited about the coming age of machine learning, he was a little saddened by it because as a programmer, he really loved getting under the hood and writing instructions and having command over this world. And now with machine learning, it's a much more abstracted kind of control. You can't, as he put it, you know, you can't cut off a head and look inside and see how the brain works.
Now, it is the case that coders are needed to create apps and things with simple functionality on our gadgets, correct?
Oh, of course. Yeah. And I should just say, look, I mean, we have this provocative headline, The End of Code. You know, coding is not going away anytime soon. And I certainly don't mean to imply that it is. The coding-based worldview where everything is kind of understandable, you can break everything down to parts. And once you understand an algorithm, you can tweak it and optimize it. That idea is going to go away more and more as machine learning takes up more and more of the computing that we do.
No, that's the Wired thing, the end of the internet, the
right.
End of computing, all the things that are still here. You do it.
Yes, but if you look at it, I think a lot of the times we are pretty good at identifying trends in that way. You know,
I think this is dead on.
Well, yeah, thank you. And when we said the web is dead, for instance, right?
Right.
We were talking about the rise of walled gardens and the rise of Facebook and the end of the idea of the open web. And I think we were, frankly, not to be defensive, but I think we were right about that as well.
No, I think you were right about that. And that leads us to Joshua's idea here, which is the power of massively networked communities and societies and figuring out ways of designing to understand how you anticipate what it is they do, either for marketing purposes or for democracy or for mind control. Which do you prefer, democracy, mind control?
I think the argument which flows very naturally out of this is and the point I try to explore in the book is we're sort of entering an era where the initial age of networks that we experience is about to get much more complex. First of all, the networks are going to be instant. They're going to be zero latency networks. So things will happen very, very quickly.
Right.
And part of the nature of that is things will be happening so fast that you'll need to use AI. You'll need to use machines to solve problems because we want more and more speed. This is actually maybe one of the most surprising things that occurred to me in the process of kind of discovering the book and talking to people, which was what the networks are built for is speed. They're built to compress time in the way that the great inventions of the Industrial Revolution compress space, trains, planes, ships. What the networks allow us to do is to do things more quickly, more rapidly, and they seem to crave that. And developing that instinct, what I call in the book the seventh sense, in the Industrial Revolution, Nietzsche said, stuff is happening so fast, our five senses aren't enough. We need a sixth sense, which for him was a feeling for history, or we'll go crazy. As you know, in Nietzsche's case, he kind of did end up going crazy anyhow.
Right. Or he was crazy to begin with.
To begin with, yeah. That in our age, we need this kind of new sense for what it means to be constantly enmeshed. And part of that gets to this very important issue, which is, where is the human in the loop? As we start to have more and more AI in our systems, as we understand, today we can barely think of an object that's not connected. In a few years, to think of every object also as being informed by AI also requires a very new sensibility.
Well, you asked the question, where is the human in the loop? When I deal with my teenagers who cannot distinguish between their emotional life outside of the network and their emotional life inside of the network, the question is, where is the human out of the loop?
Yeah, I think this is a super relevant question today in the political context. I mean, all this is very interesting in the code context and the technology context, but the reality is technology maps onto society. We're in the midst of what I think is a profound network election in many ways, and the way in which people are thinking about the world is exactly this issue, which is this ability to make a distinction between what they see on their social network and what actually goes on in the real world is sort of disappearing.
All right, let me back you both down here. How is what you're talking about different from the unanticipated consequences of something as complex as Gutenberg's printing press, which he said, we're going to make some Bibles, folks, and the users decided, no, we're going to have the Protestant Reformation,
right,
and we're going to have 10,000 other things, and
yeah,
we're going to do a million. Is this fundamentally different from that unanticipated consequences of complex social systems engaged with technology, or is it the same thing, just times a thousand?
I mean,
billion?
My view of it is structurally it's the same, in the sense that there was a whole way of doing business before the Reformation, and then the process of the Reformation through the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution essentially wiped out every institution in Europe over a 300-year period because they were built for the wrong structures. I think that same thing is about to happen now. If you look at our age, there's almost no institution today that's more legitimate than it was 10 years ago. And the problem is that they were architected for a world of industrial power, not of network power.
There's almost no institution that's more legitimate today than it was 10 years ago?
Yeah.
I think that's right.
That is an unintended consequence of a lot of these networks that we're talking about. You know, if you look at, for instance, the impact that Facebook is having on the election today versus the impact that it had on, the revolutions across the Middle East. There was a story we ran 6 years ago or so about how Facebook was enabling great protests and all this freedom and liberty. Obviously, the conclusion of that story was very different than we thought it was when going into it.
We're talking with Jason Tanz, editor-at-large at Wired, and Joshua Cooper Ramo, author of The Seventh Sense.
John, I would say one other point just to go back to your Gutenberg analogy, which I think is actually really interesting in the AI context. One of the other distinctions about Gutenberg is that that process of the scientific revolution and what Gutenberg was doing was about putting more and more information into people's hands. It was really the age of reason. Mm-hmm. Kant famously said that the motto of the Enlightenment should be dare to know. I think one of the interesting things about AI and these computer systems is that we live in a world of increasing what I call in the book black boxing of systems, that things disappear into these algorithms in ways that we can't understand. And so the scientific revolution was really about humans discovering the answers to questions ourselves with our own minds. Where we are today is a point where the machines may be able to solve scientific problems or even commercial problems or economic problems better than any human can, and we won't know how they got the answer.
I think the scary apocalyptic models of what's going to happen are some of the least interesting. And how is it that human beings will compete with this network, or will we all just be dumbed down in some gigantic version of television, for instance?
Well, another question is, where does power sit in this network?
I want you to answer the question. I don't want another question.
Well, because the answer, are we going to be dumbed down robots, and basically are we going to be the Incas and the computers are going to be the Spaniards kind of question, comes down to this issue of where does the power sit. And I think that's maybe one of the areas we haven't yet figured out today, which is, as we were saying earlier, the guys who control the Google algorithm, who control the Facebook algorithm, they have more power arguably than any group in human history.
Any nation state?
Yeah. On what basis are they accountable? How do they make decisions? How are those algorithms programmed? And the fundamental problem is most of us can't understand that.
What do women add to this sensibility, and what would they say about, for instance, the end of code and the significance of these things?
So I think the significance is that there's this idea that algorithms are purely objective, you know, and it's just science and there's no bias in them whatsoever. But as we've seen in recent conversations around Facebook, that's not really true. You know, everything is a reflection of the ethics somehow of its creator, and that's true for algorithms as much as anything. So I think there is real concern in the AI community that if it is only a certain chunk of society that is creating AI and embedding it with their kind of understanding of the world, that is going to have a massive influence on how technology develops and therefore how society develops. And what you really need is a diversity of viewpoints and diversity of backgrounds that go into coding in what is essentially ethics in this next generation of artificial intelligence.
Part of this also is understanding that if the great breakthrough of the Enlightenment was that we were able to think of ourselves as individuals and sort of have this perspective of what I want to do with my life, I can do, that you're not, your life is not determined by who your parents are or where you're born. The nature of this age we live in now is we're all defined by what we're connected to. And one of the remarkable things in the literature is women just instinctively have a better sense of relationships. They have a better sense of kind of how things sit. When you give spatial tests to women, they tend to perform better in certain areas of matching various things together. And so this approach of relational thinking, it's very important to have diversity for all kinds of reasons in networks. We know they perform better when you have diverse points of view. And what's very important to avoid is kind of having AI or humans wander down a path of sort of very simple programming. The reality is we move into the future, the more diverse the systems are, the more powerful they're going to be.
Joshua Cooper Ramo is the author of The Seventh Sense. I urge you to get it. I also urge you to read the current issue of Wired. Jason Tanz is editor at large, The End of Code. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And Joshua, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
When the Democrats sounded like a Republican.
When I ran for president 4 years ago, I pledged to end welfare as we know it. I have worked very hard for 4 years to do just that. Today, the Congress will vote on legislation that gives us a chance to live up to that promise.
20 years ago, President Bill Clinton announced the beginning of a new era in the way the U.S. administers welfare assistance to the poor. At the time the welfare-to-work legislation was passing the House, more than 13 million people received cash assistance from the government. Today, just 3 million do. Under the law, welfare recipients had to start working after 2 years of benefits. It also placed a 5-year limit on those benefits. For those receiving welfare checks, the monthly assistance isn't enough. They have to work to pay the bills.
Chopping cotton, picking cotton, pulling corn.
Most of my job experience is call centers.
Mostly retail jobs.
Taking care of a couple of older people. I go and do their housework and stay with them as company.
Those voices are part of a podcast called The Uncertain Hour, produced by Marketplace. This season, they're taking a look at 20 years of welfare reform. Chrissy Clark is senior correspondent for Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk.
In my reporting in Wealth and Poverty, I often would hear people talking about welfare, complaining about it, talking about how much money we spend on it or all the lazy people who are on it. You hear these sort of these tropes. And I started to wonder, how does welfare work these days anyways? Because I knew that 20 years ago we reformed it and really kind of overhauled the system. And the more I dug into how the system really works now, who's on it, how much we spend on it, it was like, oh, people have no idea how this system works. We have very old-fashioned ideas about what we're talking about.
Well, one thing that's clear is that the people on welfare absolutely love it, and it's kind of like an easy street situation. Listen.
I hated welfare, to be fair with you. I really hated it. You're talked down to, and you really are completely always stressed out.
So that is Ruby Duncan, who is now 83 years old. She lives in Las Vegas, Nevada. And she was on welfare back in the 60s and 70s after she was injured on the job. And she ended up sort of becoming this unlikely activist in what is called the welfare rights movement. There was a time when welfare had a lot of discriminatory practices sort of built into the system. And Ruby Duncan started to realize this. She was at a grocery store one day and she was asking other women who were on welfare, how much in benefits do you get? And she started to see this pattern that white women got more benefits, a larger welfare check than black women did. And this was not an isolated incident. The more she looked into it, the more she discovered this was really built into a lot of policies in welfare offices. There were protests across the country in the late 60s and early 70s demanding more equity in the way welfare was distributed.
And what you see in the welfare system is an attempt to engineer social choices on the part of welfare recipients. But as you could see with Ruby Duncan, it also ends up reflecting some uncharitable impulses within society itself, in that case, racial discrimination. Here's, though, Josephine Moore, another character who you profile, who describes in some detail just how intrusive the welfare system was in her case.
It's just one more thing we had to do. If the daytime hours is stuck up with you doing the volunteer stuff, when are you going to go find jobs, though?
She was receiving welfare at this sort of pivotal moment in history, right when the system was changing in the mid-90s, as it was going from an entitlement, a program that, you know, if you made under a certain income and you met certain technical requirements, if you were a parent in a family, a poor family, you automatically received welfare benefits. You automatically received a check. There are also these other factors. So even in a place like West Virginia, where Josephine Moore lived, there are just not a lot of jobs to go around. So in order to qualify for welfare, if you can't get a paying job, you would have to be involved in some kind of work activity. And this is still the case. So you would volunteer instead. It may be a well-intentioned system, but what it means is that Josephine was volunteering for 20 to 30 hours during the day in order to get her very small welfare check, which meant that she couldn't actually look for a real paying job. So you get kind of stuck in this double bind where you maybe want to get ahead, you want to get into the workforce, but you have so much paperwork and so many requirements that you can't.
Here's Josephine Moore's daughter describing how she actually was able to get out of the welfare system and find a job and what that feels like.
It was worth it because you was working and you was earning your money, and it felt good to get in that paycheck and being able to cash it and going out and spending your money and knowing you had it.
I've done that a lot. That's true.
You had it and it was yours. It felt good.
What kind of a job is she talking about there?
She was working on an assembly line in a chicken plant, a Tyson chicken plant in North Carolina, where she had moved for a little while. And this is smelly, hard work. It can be dangerous. She actually lost a thumb on the assembly line when she was cleaning some of the equipment. But even sort of given those challenges and those sorts of costs, she still was so happy. She was so glad to be in kind of the regular workforce, to be earning her own paycheck, to not have that stigma on her that often welfare recipients feel. One of the stark facts now is that we have this safety net, this cash assistance, this welfare. Very few poor families in America actually take part in the system. Out of every 100 families that lives below the poverty line in the U.S., less than 3 of them actually receive cash assistance, what we call welfare. This safety net that we still think of as such a part of our country, a lot of people are slipping through the cracks.
Chrissy Clark, senior correspondent for Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. House and Senate finally moving on funding for combating the Zika virus that's ravaged Brazil and could threaten pregnant women in the U.S. The Senate passed its $1.1 billion bill. The House is expected to vote today on their version, which is $622 million. But that's money relocated from existing health programs. And the White House wants $1.9 billion in emergency spending. And that request has gone really unanswered by the Congress. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Who's got the priorities straight and what are the priorities as you go down the White House to the Senate and the House, Todd?
Yeah, and there's a great deal of argument over those priorities, how far the money goes, and when you're going to have to come back to address a public health crisis that nobody thinks is going away. There's a little bit of an accusation of robbing Peter to pay Paul here, because some of the money, a lot of the money, at least in the House, that they want to spend on Zika comes from the account that's for Ebola, saying, well, you didn't spend it on Ebola, that's over, so we'll just take that money and spend it here. Public health experts are warning that that's foolhardy, because there's no reason to believe that Ebola is actually gone, and there's still plenty of programs in Africa to prevent the resurgence of Ebola. So therein lies the debate. You were right. $1.1 billion is what the Senate got done. The money goes to a number of different places. The CDC has mosquito eradication and control efforts. That's spraying, mosquito nets, new technology. Vaccine development's a big one. They want to try to get that online fast. The public health scientists have been telling Congress that Zika is the kind of virus that is amenable to a vaccine, John, so they can get one online. But it takes a long time for this money to get through the pipeline. It's not like Congress passes it and the bench scientists say, voila, vaccine the next day. It doesn't work like that. So every day of delay in the Congress costs them a lot of time on the scientific end. There's money for women and child health because, of course, this affects pregnant women and their infants in a big way. There's also some foreign aid through the State Department for countries like Brazil. That's mostly in the Senate version. Now, there was a bipartisan agreement here. You were right. The White House asked for $1.9 billion. Some Republicans agreed with that. Most Republicans wouldn't go for it. Some Republicans, along with Patty Murray, the Democratic budget chair, had to strike a deal. It was $1.1 billion. She wasn't happy with it, but said it was the best she could get. Here's Patty Murray.
This is a crisis. It is an emergency, and it is truly shameful that Republicans have tied the administration's hand and prevented them from protecting our families.
Now, Todd, are we absolutely sure this is a crisis? I mean, it is certainly the virus of the moment, but are there other healthcare issues that are being forgotten in all of this Zika focus?
Look, there are always other healthcare issues. Here is the issue when the experts are informing members of Congress. 500 cases of Zika in the United States so far, almost all of them travel related. 700 cases in U.S. territories, though, John, almost all of those locally acquired. What does that mean? That places like Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, all of those southern territories, It's mosquitoes. And when the mosquitoes come south over the spring and summer, you can bet the Zika comes with it. Now, Marco Rubio is from one of those southern jurisdictions. He's from Florida, the conservative Republican who's back in the Senate after the campaign trail. He wanted the full $1.9 billion the White House asked for, and Rubio had a warning for fellow Republicans in the House.
Why take the chance that at some point this summer we could have a significant and serious outbreak in the United States of America, and everybody here is going to be back in their home state doing their campaign stuff or whatever you're doing this summer, and you're going to have to come back here and either deal with it and explain to people why, when doctors and medical experts were warning us that this was a significant risk, we decided to lowball it. We decided to spend less than what's being called for.
Marco Rubio on the Zika summer.
Yeah, from Florida, of course, and you can see why those southern lawmakers want more money. They're going to have to reach an agreement to find some middle ground, and that's going to take another few weeks at least, John.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
You bet.
And now, how network citizens can amplify the power of a single enthusiastic scientist.
Everything went wrong, and the students loved it. I mean, they really realized that this is what real research is. I mean, if it were simple, it would just be called search, right? But it's not. It's research.
Lee Konstedt is a Kansas-based entomologist with the USDA Agricultural Research Service and head of the Invasive Mosquito Project, part of the government effort to stay ahead of the Zika virus and other insect-borne pathogens. The Invasive Mosquito Project has been calling on everyone from gardeners to schoolchildren to collect mosquito eggs in their communities and to get in touch with their local mosquito control districts that have existed since the early 20th century to fight malaria. Now they're being mobilized to create a nationwide dynamic map to track mosquito distribution and sort the bad guys from the good guys. Of course, dangerous mosquitoes are all female. Lee Konstedt says that all it takes to join the effort is a cup and a paper towel.
Put out a cup with some paper inside it, like a paper towel. Just make sure that cup stays about one-third to half full. The mosquitoes will actually lay their eggs on that paper, and then you can rear those mosquitoes in a safe environment and have the professionals near you help you identify them.
No one's ever argued that mosquitoes are particularly intelligent, but why would they breed in a cup with a napkin in it?
That's just the way they are. So the mosquitoes we're targeting in this project are container breeding mosquitoes. And those mosquitoes are all over the environment. And because of this sort of natural history trait of breeding in cups or breeding in small containers, they were able to expand their ranges. People moved these mosquitoes to different locations. And so that's why it's called the Invasive Mosquito Project. And so that behavioral trait allows us to take advantage of that and monitor them. And so we're not only monitoring the ones that are here, but we're also looking for ones that may come in to recent introductions of mosquitoes.
How recent would these introductions be? It seems to me that the populations and genetic composition of mosquitoes would be pretty much diffused by this point.
Well, because of these traits that we just talked about, where they live in containers and they're able to move, so easily. There are species, particularly 80 species, that are moved all around the world. So just a couple of years ago, there was an introduction of Aedes nodunectus in California, and there have been routine introductions of Aedes aegypti, which is in the U.S., but it's moving to different locations. And that's the whole idea, is to find out where those are and when they're moving into these areas.
What can you do with this crowdsourced group of citizen scientists in scale that you're unable to do just by yourself?
Well, what we wanted to do is we wanted to do continental sampling of mosquitoes back in 2011 and 2012. And that's just not feasible. I mean, logistically, resource-wise, and time-wise, you can't sample an entire continent in 1 year. At least that's how it was previously thought. But we were able to connect and link all of the mosquito control districts. And so we got a pretty good map of what the mosquito distributions look like for some of them. But we thought we can do this better. We can get a finer scale, and we can get people involved. And if we're trying to help people, they really need to be part of the solution. And one aspect of this that we did not anticipate was how enthusiastic the students and teachers would be to participate in this. So the first year we did this in 2014, it was an utter failure. I mean, nothing worked. You know, we described it as you just put a cup out, right? But in Kansas, it's pretty windy here, and those cups all blew over, or they evaporated, or they overflowed because we had a rainstorm. I mean, everything went wrong, and the students loved it. I mean, they really realized that this is what real research is. I mean, if it were simple, it would just be called search, right? But it's not. It's research. They were so enthusiastic to do it the next year, and so then in 2015, we had it optimized, and they did it, and we said, this is great. And so each state and each group is going to have to adjust to make it work. But that's part of research, and this is the data that they're collecting. And hopefully, this project will continue nationwide, but also year to year. We hope that this will continue for, you know, 20 years or so. And so people can see changes in mosquito distribution, changes in what's happening with the changing climate that we have and the changing global environment. That way, we have long-term data that all the students collected that they're using for their reports. And that's what makes it really powerful. And that's what they really like. And the teachers like that too.
Lee Konstad is head of the Invasive Mosquito Project. He's a Kansas-based entomologist with the USDA Agricultural Research Service. Thanks so much, Lee.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So at the beginning of the hour, we were having this kind of Mount Olympus discussion about how producers create content, technology breeds unanticipated consequences, platforms of big data are devoid of morality, and deep learning computers don't much care if you're an angel or an arch villain. Well, take the actual case of the database and watchdog tool from ProPublica called Prescriber Checkup. By detailing the prescribing habits of hundreds of thousands of doctors across the country, ProPublica hoped that journalists might have a comprehensive source and a tool for tracking the opioid and prescription painkiller epidemic. Using Prescriber Checkup, Americans could select a responsible doctor who might responsibly prescribe opioids rather than one with a pattern of doling out painkillers with abandon. Well, ProPublica discovered that since the database started in 2013, some are using it to actually find doctors who would more willingly prescribe their drug of choice. Steve Engelberg is the editor-in-chief of ProPublica. He joins me now in the studio here at WNYC. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
My first comment is, this is what addicts do. They take advantage of things like this. Hello.
Yeah. No, I mean, our sort of goal in all this was a little bit broader. I mean, what we wanted to do, having obtained this Medicare data, was put up the prescribing habits of doctors of all kinds of medications so that one could do all kinds of research. I mean, one of the things that we were very interested in, for example, was we have a database of pharmaceutical company payments to doctors. And one of the great questions is, do payments influence the practice of medicine? Mm. And Big Pharma has always said, no, it doesn't. Well, until you had a database that looked at what a normal doctor in any given field does, you couldn't see whether they departed from the norm. So ultimately, what we did just this year was a story that looked at, okay, did doctors who get lots of payments tend to give more prescription drugs rather than generic? The answer was yes. So, you know, we had a sort of broad sense of how people would use this, and we believe that people did use it broadly. A narrower group, which is the opioid-seeking group, did turn out to use it in ways, we think, at least in some cases, that we did not intend.
Now, it's also the case that those users can lead law enforcement to perhaps find doctors who are contributing to the epidemic, if it indeed that is the case.
Right. I mean, one of the things that came out when we first did this, we identified the top 20 opioid sort of prescribers around the country. We discovered that a fairly large number, about half of them, were in trouble in various ways. Some of them were being had already been banned from Medicaid for abusive prescribing patterns, yet Medicare, another federal program, hadn't even looked. So one of the things that we felt would happen is that if we put this data up there, we would encourage federal authorities, regulators, law enforcement to take a closer look at something that was just being pretty much spent willy-nilly. And that did happen. So, you know, again, we felt like we had a lot of people using this for the purpose it was intended. And then as we discovered recently, some that were not.
How do you keep track of the way people use your database?
Well, it's a little bit unclear. You can't really tell the intent or motive of somebody coming to a website. Our analytics allow us to look at some of the web searches, and I have to say some of them were a little suspect, like, how do I find a doctor who will prescribe me anything? That seems like somebody who may not be looking for medical purposes. But it is true, and it's very important to emphasize, that people who are coming to this site have a potential mix of motives. We've had a sort of pendulum swing in the pain medication field, and today it's probably harder to get opioids than it used to. So what if you have chronic pain and you can't find a doctor who's willing to treat that? So I think some people use the website to find sort of legitimate treatment for legitimate problems. Other people are using it because they've become hooked and they're trying to abuse the drugs. And so our response was to try to put on each of the warning pages where this occurs a warning label explaining the sort of consequences of these drugs, the background of the epidemic, and so on.
Is this taking place outside of insurance? For instance, the Schedule I or Controlled Substances Act makes it difficult to get prescriptions on a greater frequency than insurance will reimburse. And so you can't, you know, upload or get multiple prescriptions because they're keeping track of all of that.
Yeah, I don't think we have clarity on what's happening at the end-use phase. What we do know is that the amount of traffic on this particular news application is pretty heavy and, you know, a bit heavier than we would expect. And so, you know, by our very rough calculation, we're thinking that about 25% of the people coming to the site are looking for opioids. And of that group, some, maybe a majority, maybe not, you know, are looking to abuse it. How they do that, I think, is a reporting question, and it's the kind of thing we have been writing about over the years about this.
Can you tell how people are using prescription opioids versus the heroin actual crisis itself, people getting heroin off the street?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I do think we know from our reporting that people who are buying heroin often buy it because it's cheaper and easier to get than the prescription drugs. As you say, there are some things in the system now that prevent people from, you know, just openly abusing it, getting multiple prescriptions and so on.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Steven Engelberg is the editor-in-chief of ProPublica. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
This is the true story. True story.
Seven strangers.
Reality has a birthday coming up. Did you realize that? You see, Reality was born on May 21st, 1992.
I've done some mean things, but this is mean, especially to leave him hanging like that.
The Real World on MTV started it all. That clip from the first season, young people living out their unscripted lives in an impulse of exhibitionism over drama. The youthful disclosures of a group of people on their own in an awesome apartment in New York City. Famous for no reason, they spoke the language of Facebook before Facebook. Before the internet turned all of civilization into a reality show.
The very first Real World, which took place here in New York, was probably, I'd say, less celebrity in the beginning. It was really not about the 15 minutes of fame that I think has become now for some people, but a true documentary.
Producer and entrepreneur Chris Abrego was there for the beginning of so-called reality TV as a lowly production assistant, and he rode the media wave. He survived Survivor.
I plead to the jury tonight to think a little bit about the island that we have been on. This island is pretty much full of only two things, snakes and rats.
Survivor was Real World with snakes, rats, and hard bodies. 52 million viewers watched the season finale on CBS. By then, reality television had also become American Idol and The Bachelor, next Top Model, Top Chef, the bottom-feeding Snooki on the Jersey Shore.
This is the things that I think I'm addicted to. Bronzer, boys, and alcohol.
There was Housewives of New York and Atlanta and Points West.
Our guest Chris Abrego is now caught in the heyday of Game of Thrones, House of Cards, and other scripted and streamed content. He is the co-CEO of Endemol North America, which oversees shows such as MasterChef and Big Brother, which has found success on Telemundo as Gran Hermano. Abrego says outdoing the last hit and staying fresh is the mad creative challenge of reality TV.
I think it just became the evolution of television. If I had to pick one person, I would give some credit, a lot of the credit, to Mark Burnett when he really broke out Survivor. Just on a simple level of production value, when reality TV was on cable and was shot like the real world was being shot by three cameras, you know, the kind of shakiness in the camera, the handheld camera. But when you see Survivor at a network level with being shot with 24 cameras and this incredible B-roll and helicopter aerials, and it made that transition easier at the prime time level.
But it was competing also with the reality TV show Millionaire.
Absolutely.
Which was just people sitting in a seat answering questions.
Yeah, well, that, you know, the game show, you can always, is a version of every reality show because they're real contestants. But in terms of a narrative or a competition format that really had not been seen before, and where Survivor went out and to compete with dramas and compete with sitcoms. And of course, there's a price point too for unscripted television that is much, much less than a big drama or a comedy.
And in the network model, that's what happened. I mean, reality TV really buried scripted television until just recently.
You know, yeah, I think when you really look at that cycle is what you're referring to, the best story always wins, scripted or unscripted. A good movie is a good movie, right? I think in the time where unscripted was really outpacing and beating scripted, it wasn't probably as great as it could have been. But then what you saw happening was a lot of that scripted started to stay the same and not change. But in cable, scripted started taking a lot of chances.
But the on-demand issue is disruptive in an interesting way for reality TV. I mean, do people want to see MasterChef, you know, on demand? Or is it something for people who are just sitting around who all they have is cable and lots of spare time?
No, I think, you know, is reality the genre that'll drive streaming or on demand right now? Maybe not so much today, but it's going to be. All the streaming will eventually become like a network where it'll need everything, right? It'll need some things live. It'll need something scripted, it'll need some comedy, and it'll need some non-scripted.
What have you learned from your experience with Spanish-speaking audiences in terms of pushing reality into a place that is most comfortable with narrative television or kind of celebrity talk television?
Yeah, no, it's very true. You know, what we've learned is that they're hungry. They are very hungry for original ideas or ideas that you could find in general market but get them in Spanish. So, for example, we were able to do Big Brother this last year, which was great. And then we're bringing original ideas like we just had on NBC Universal, a show called El Vato, which is, you know, shot in and around Los Angeles. And that's something that Spanish-speaking audience here in the U.S. is not used to seeing, shows shot here in the U.S., not a novella that's picked up from another country, another territory, and looks like it could be anywhere.
You could do a telenovela in Washington, D.C. with
Absolutely. The
size of the Latin-speaking audience.
That's exactly the point. The stories that we need to tell now for Spanish, you know, audiences, it's exactly what they want. They've lived here for a long time. They're now their second, third generation Spanish speakers, and they know this country, and there's stories that are relevant to them here, and those are the stories that we're putting together.
So unscripted would be Empire meets the tortilla business in Chicago.
Absolutely. You know what? There's an idea. There's a Mexican-American family in Chicago. The husband runs a landscaping business, but high-end. But the wife runs a landscape architect business, incredibly high-end. I think the Obama's house is on her client
list. That's cool.
And they have a fight over, he's like a mow-and-blow guy, and she's an artist. And so there's always a controversy in the house. So that's an idea that's going out
terrific.
As a pitch on it.
I like
and
that.
And it's fun, and it's kind of it's being called Across the Lawn.
I love that.
Yeah, so that's so.
It says a lot about the community itself.
Correct. But there's a lot of ideas in that area. We're working on an entertainment project with a lot of artists. We have a project where we mix and match, in a sense. Randy Jackson from American Idol, his next-door neighbor happened to be a gentleman named Pepe Aguilar, who's a massive Mexican icon singer, put the two of them for a project, and we're taking that out to Spanish markets.
I know neither of those people there, but that's, you know, my ignorance. Sure. But that is really the deal with on-demand. Audiences don't overlap necessarily. Does on-demand allow you to make more shows, or does on-demand force you to be much smarter about the kinds of things that people really, really want?
Well, on-demand does give you the ability to make more shows, but you absolutely do want to be smarter, right? You might have a really strong TV show, but because of the saturation of so many projects in that space, could get lost. That's the biggest fight right now, is breaking out. You know, there's so much content being made, which is great, but really getting that content to stand out and break out and getting people to notice it and watch it and find it, that's where the real wins are.
Chris Abrego is co-CEO of Endemol Shine North America and author of the memoir Make It Reality, Create Your Opportunity, Own Your Success. Hey, take this with you, folks. The results of a 2014 technology and engineering test are in, and 8th grade girls are on top. 45% were proficient compared to 42% of their male peers. It's the first time the National Report Card has measured students' understanding of design and information technology, but on other math and science tests, usually boys score higher than girls, but not this time. A sign of challenges that remain for us, though. Only 25% of low-income students who received reduced-price lunches passed those same tests. We've got to stay ahead of the machines, people. Come on. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.